Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks. This episode of Breaking Banks is supported by Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast and radio show. I am your host, Brett King, and with me in the hosting chair today, co-hosting is JP Nichols.
Yes, hello.
How are you?
I'm doing okay, ready for this lockdown to end, but we can't. So here we are.
Well, they're talking about the third wave coming now, right, in the U.S. So,
well, you know, this is really just an expansion of the first wave. So although we've been doing okay here in Washington, you know, our friends in the Midwest are getting hit pretty hard. And we're going to talk about Europe today. And we're seeing a second wave hitting large parts of Europe as well.
And when you say Washington, of course, Washington State.
Correct.
So, well, great to have you on. Joining us all the way from Luxembourg today is someone who's been on the show before and is a good friend and contact in, you know, a network powerhouse in the Luxembourg and European fintech space, Nasser Zubairi. Is that right, the pronunciation of your...
It's good enough, Brett. It's fine. Thank you.
I've
known with this for 45 years. It's fine. Anything is acceptable, pretty much.
And you are currently the CEO of The Loft, which is the Luxembourg House of FinTech. So tell me about Loft, because I know we've had you guys on the show before, but for those that didn't catch that, what does the Luxembourg House of Financial Technology do?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Brett. So we are quite unique in terms of our role here in Luxembourg, and I think unique as a structure internationally as well, in that we are a genuine collaboration between the public and the private sector to ensure the future competitiveness of Luxembourg's financial services industry with a focus on digitalization. Obviously, given the foundation of your work, you understand how critical that is to financial services going forward. And in that sense, it's not just, you know, talk. It is actual genuine collaboration. The Minister of Finance of Luxembourg, Pierre Gramegna, is our chairman, a very, very proactive chairman on our behalf. And the private sector really are working hand in hand with the public sector to promote and to develop the digital capacity of the Luxembourg financial services arena. So
now,
as a center point for all that.
When we talk about fintech and the growth of fintech, obviously, when most fintechs start, you know, the startups that are emerging for fintech, most of them are SMEs, small businesses, you know, until they get the first couple of rounds of funding out of the way, typically. And so what's it like getting a small business set up in Luxembourg?
It's relatively straightforward, and part of our role therein is to act as a chaperone, act as a point of support, to hold their hand and to lead them through the process, to make sure that they have the right contacts, and to get up and running in the most effective way they can. But that's not just the sort of logistical and business support, but also community support. You know, Luxembourg is an incredibly international country. I mean, over 50% of the population are foreigners. A lot of the businesses that come to set up in Luxembourg are coming from abroad. And, you know, when you come to a new country, it's not just about getting up and running and understanding the bureaucracy. It's also about getting comfortable yourself and your team comfortable. Often firms are bringing in people from their existing operations, wherever they may be. And you know, we build a sense of community so that they also feel comfortable and happy within Luxembourg and want to be here and enjoy doing business here.
Do you find people coming in from other parts of Europe to Luxembourg because it, you know, because of the flexibility of, and because of the capital flows that go through the market?
Yes, of course. I mean, there's a variety of reasons why people choose to come to Luxembourg. One of those is its competence in international business. I mean, Luxembourg is 600,000 people. People do not come to Luxembourg to service the local market. They come here to service, I guess, firstly, the European market, and secondly, the international and global market. So, you know, we have a strong competence in enabling that to occur. So if there's a place in Europe where you truly can, you know, look to build a global business with the competences you need around that, you have that skill set here. But then critically alongside that is the language capacity. You know, I'm sitting here as a very proud Brit still in many ways. I don't speak a word of French or German, and I sit in the heart of Europe and I do not have a problem. I call this place my home. It's fantastic, right? English, French, German, Luxembourgish, Portuguese, Spanish. I mean, you can find someone here that you can do business with in all of those languages, which also helps in developing your business across the European Union and dealing with the different cultures. So there are many strong points to doing business. And I guess the final pillar of that is in fintech is the, you know, the closeness of the market, access to decision makers. We have 125 banks. We have the world's fund industry, increasingly the private equity industry, the cross-border insurance industry for Europe. And, you know, you go on a Saturday morning, you're going to bump into God knows how many CEOs shopping at your local grocery store. Everyone knows everyone, and you get access to them very, very easily. So your time to market, your sales cycle, tends to be a lot shorter here, because you know you can get access to the right people very easily.
Well, historically, your leadership in Luxembourg has been around asset management and you know, assets under management and kind of global wealth. How's that been changing over the last few years, and especially since COVID? What kinds of things are you seeing, and what are you focused on lately?
Well, aside from a massive boost in digital transformation as a result of COVID, but I think that's been happening everywhere. And maybe we'll park that and come back to that in a second. I mean, what was really interesting, asset management, yes, has been the core of Luxembourg's business. Alongside that, for many years, private banking was also a huge sector, but had seen some level of decline in the past 5-6 years. What I'm told is that industry, private banking, had a huge boost during COVID because Luxembourg is seen as relatively secure, both politically, economically, and we saw massive asset inflows coming into Luxembourg from particularly high net worths and ultra high net worths, given the economic uncertainty in very many other countries, particularly across Europe. Where else? I wouldn't say anything specific to COVID, but more as a result of Brexit, has been a huge boost to the private equity and insurance sector as well, with the likes of, you know, AIG setting up their corporate business here to service Europe, and many, many private equity firms choosing Luxembourg as their European base.
Now, how about there are a number of business interruption loan schemes that have been going on across Europe. And you know, I think both the UK and the US have kind of struggled with their respective programs. Some countries have done better than others. What has Luxembourg's role been in that?
Well, in that, I mean, it's played a critical role as a country, given that we house the European Investment Bank and the European Investment Fund, which are largely orchestrating a lot of these recovery packages. So therein, there's been a big spotlight. I think with Luxembourg's finance industry and expertise, obviously, the Pierre Gramegna, the Minister of Finance, as you may know, has twice been runner-up in the elections for the ECOFIN Council, which is basically the Council of Finance Ministers, and plays a pivotal role in that in that council regardless, given his length of tenure as a finance minister relative to others in Europe. So we do have large sway in that, and there's been some good case studies. I mean, looking around the world, there really probably hasn't been many places that have dealt with COVID as effectively as Luxembourg did. I mean, I don't want to rattle off all the processes and procedures here, but as a private citizen and as a business citizen, this country has really pulled out all stops to ensure that it's been handled in the most incredible way, really.
Well, maybe it is worth just highlighting one or two of those things, because I think so many areas have struggled with that. What was maybe the top one or two things that you felt Luxembourg did better than others?
Well, obviously the shining light is mass testing, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone gets tested. I've had 9 tests so far. Mm. You arrive at the airport, you're given a certificate to go and have a test. You can have the test done at the airport. All the cross-border commuters can get free tests in Luxembourg. I mean, it's of a scale that's unprecedented for a population. Yeah, the population is small. But the medical capacity of Luxembourg obviously is relative to that population. So it's still a big initiative for Luxembourg to do that.
Right.
Alongside that is obviously the very, very agile way in which the government implemented support schemes for businesses, partial unemployment, chômage partiel, to basically cover wages for employees, bank guarantees so that firms could get access to capital from the retail banks within Luxembourg. More specifically and relevant for this conversation, increased the innovation investment capacity within Luxembourg as well. So be it that we do work under EU guidelines, as every country in the EU does, there are certain points of flexibility, and there are a variety of EU subsidy schemes that we obviously do administer and deliver to young startups or young innovative enterprises, as they're called. So they readjusted the ratios on those. Typically, it was sort of matched funding on a 50-50 basis. Now it's 70-30. So the government's really stepped up to try and help out and provide incentives and ensure the continuity of business and innovation.
Now, with the potential of a hard Brexit coming, given we've seen over the last couple of weeks, how have you gone about ensuring, do you have residency in Luxembourg now, or how are you dealing with it as a UK passport holder?
Well, I am resident. Technically, I can continue to be resident in Luxembourg, but yes, I am looking at some of my alternatives. I can apply for a Luxembourgish passport next year, which I'm contemplating. I am half Polish, so technically I should be able to get a Polish passport as well, but my Polish is not up to scratch, really, and if there is a complex language, that truly is one. So, I mean, I do have very many options, but I'm not worried in the immediate aftermath of being suddenly ejected from the country. So.
No, I'm just wondering. No, I don't expect that, but I'm just wondering if there's been I know Berlin saw some influx of startups, with the UK, Brexit. Has Luxembourg also seen, bump in activity given the sort of change with the UK's positioning in the EU?
Absolutely. I mean, payment firms, obviously, it's more related to regulated entities. I mean, unregulated entities, I mean, the two focus areas within Luxembourg, given the traditional industry here and the competencies, have been payments and RegTech, right? RegTech, yes, we've had some inflow, more because of the business opportunity as opposed to the necessity of Brexit. But with payments and regulated firms, yes, there's been a huge spike. Luxembourg has one of the, if not the, sort of payment centers within Europe. That's traditional from being the first country to have implemented the PSD1 regulations way back, 2007, 2008, something like that, where we then saw the likes of Amazon Payments, PayPal, and others sort of flow into Luxembourg and set up their European headquarters here. So a lot of payment firms have applied for and been granted licenses to operate across Europe out of Luxembourg. What's been very shocking has been in the past few months, finding and getting calls from UK businesses, and some of them decent size as well, who have suddenly realized that Brexit is happening, right? And are totally and utterly unprepared. We'll see a number of payment firms that will no longer be able to operate come December 31st. It is ransom.
That's pretty crazy, right?
Yeah.
You know, that they leave it to the last minute, just hoping for a deal that lets them continue as a status quo. So, what is the makeup of sort of the business environment in Luxembourg? I know, you know, I've lived in Hong Kong, which is in National Financial Center. Like over 95% of businesses are SMEs in Hong Kong. What's the mix in Luxembourg?
Not quite that extreme. It's around two-thirds of businesses are SMEs and SMBs in Luxembourg, and about the equivalent in terms of employment as well of the economy, of people in the economy.
And how do you think? I mean, I know JP talked about the loans and so forth, but how have the small businesses in Luxembourg generally held up during COVID?
I mean, during COVID.
Yes. I mean, it's been tough everywhere, right? But
it's been tough everywhere. Yes, okay. We haven't seen mass bankruptcies. Obviously, the sectors that has been hit hardest is Horeca, hotels, restaurants, etc. Luxembourg has opened up relatively quickly after the confinement. I mean, the bars and restaurants, be it with rules, have been operating now for quite a number of months, be it not to the capacity that they could previously. Time will tell, Brett. I think, you know, just as with anything of this kind of nature, the impact to an economy is delayed in many ways, right? Because firms do find ways to meet short-term liquidity issues, but eventually those means run out, right? And that's when we'll start seeing problems. I mean, as I said, you know, the hotel sector, I mean, you know, hotels are lying empty just as they are in most places.
Certainly. Right?
So it's a problem, yeah? So time is going to tell. I mean, I think nobody's going to escape unscathed from this, yeah? And as a result, the banking sector is also going to be hit, even though in many ways it's some people are touting it as the savior for this crisis, as opposed to the villain, as it was last time round. But it'll be interesting to see how European banking will shape up in the next 4 or 5 years, given the potential debt crisis that is coming.
Well, and part of that is a credit gap on the side of those small and medium-sized enterprises across Europe. I mean, is there capital that you're deploying from within Luxembourg to help, or is there technology that you're using to help deliver that better or more efficiently?
Technology, not so much. I think that's being delivered and developed in each jurisdiction itself. Mm-hmm. Capital, obviously, yes, because a lot of firms centralize their operations and particularly their debt books out of Luxembourg as well. There's a large corporate lending business here as well out of Luxembourg for the European Union. But it's not so much the debt that's being sent out today, because a lot of that debt is, let's face it, being backed by guarantees across, be it at EU level or country level. It's more the issue is the loans that had been granted before COVID, which are not guaranteed.
Right.
And, you know, those, nobody anticipated COVID, obviously, and the problems that will arise. So there will be defaults. And when you're looking at the KPIs across the European banking sector, which are quite honestly appalling, only Japan has worse KPIs in banking than the European Union. You're talking about an average of 5.9% return on equity, 2% return on tangible equity.
And that's not sustainable.
That's not sustainable. When you then look at maybe more specific ratios and KPIs, I always like to look at Texas ratio, which is the ratio of debt, non-performing loans to tangible equity. I mean, some countries, some banks on mass in, say, Italy are way over 100% already. Yes. That, again, is unsustainable. right? So there are going to be big changes in the
Isn't it funny because there's a lot of people talking about the, you know, where's the business model for the fintechs, you know, and how are they going to survive it? The neobanks, more so the challenges, right?
Yeah.
And yet we see the exactly the same issues, fundamental issues emerging in banking currently because of low interest environment, net interest income and so forth. This is why we need digitization of the financial services sector.
And I mean, talking about the low interest rate environment, and another key factor that acts on this, on what I'm going to talk about in a second, is the increasing scrutiny and regulation around AML. I mean, European SMEs, and it is across Europe, are getting hit hard in their ability to open bank accounts generally, right? It's getting harder and harder for a small business to open a bank account within the European Union because, firstly, a bank doesn't want deposits, doesn't want people to have bank accounts because of the cost of those bank accounts, but also because of increasing regulation on AML, which is making it harder for firms to acquire bank accounts because banks don't want to take any risk whatsoever. We see this quite sort of punitive issue, particularly within the crypto markets, right? I mean, if you do crypto assets anywhere in the European Union these days, I mean, good luck to you if you're trying to get a bank account. It's pretty damn tough.
Well, and that's not going to go away, right? I mean, not anytime soon, at least. That trend line is kind of heading in that same direction. And when you combine that with what you cited a few minutes ago, if the return on equity isn't above the cost of capital, just by definition, it's not sustainable. How does this resolve itself? Is it just more consolidation? I mean, how are you thinking about this as you look forward a few years?
Well, going back to something we talked about in the early part of the conversation, digital is critical because if anything, it can help lower costs and therefore help to at least provide manageable KPIs and profitability and margins for the traditional banking sector. And so we've seen a huge increase in attention to firms, particularly say within the KYC, AML area, digital signatures, digital boarding, things like digital board meetings as well, right? Because nobody can have a physical board meeting at the moment. You can't get everyone in the room. So there is increased and quite rapid interest in these kind of solutions by the banking sector. But yes, I mean, consolidation is bound to happen. The European Union has kind of set a precedent for that. I mean, a few months ago, it might have passed a little bit under the radar, but there were some changes to European laws that are now allow cross-border mergers within the financial services sector to be significantly easier. And those have been rumored for a while, you know, SocGen and Intesa Sao Paulo, right? I mean, there's the old boys club, I think you might be aware of, the four guys that all went to school together, you know, that run SocGen, Intesa, Deutsche, and the guy that used to run Credit Suisse, or were all classmates together. Right.
And probably related to Queen Victoria at some point.
Yeah. The old boys club still operates. So there is rumors of pretty large mergers occurring at some point. Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that I think you're right. Consolidation is coming, and it sounds like Luxembourg is going to be well positioned for that, regardless of whatever the outcome is. So Nasser Zebari from Loft Foundation, thanks for joining us today. Banking Circle's proprietary technology enables payments businesses and banks of any scale to seize opportunities, compete, and grow. From multi-currency accounts to fast access to lending services, international payments and local clearing to real-time FX, Banking Circle solutions are quick, low-cost, and secure. Bypass legacy systems and enable global banking services for your clients. Banking Circle, the financial infrastructure provider you can bank on. Find out more at bankingcircle.com. .com 2020 has been the year of uncertainty, and if nothing else, it's taught us the value of being lean and staying flexible. And Fiverr can help you find the right freelance talent to do just that. Fiverr is an online marketplace that connects businesses with all kinds of freelancers. Fiverr makes it easy to run and scale your business by helping you find the right resources, and you only pay for what you need when you need it. I like Fiverr's search engine. It's built right into their main page.
You can search for all kinds of experts, and you have plenty to choose from at really affordable rates. It's easy to find what you need. You can search by service, deadline, price, seller reviews, and more. I've hired some great freelancers recently for logos and art design, audio engineering, and for a complex data visualization project. You'll know exactly what you're paying for up front. No guessing games and no negotiating needed. Whether you're launching a new business, scaling up a growing one, or you just need some extra support to complete a project, Fiverr's global network is here to help, and they have 24/7 customer service. Check out Fiverr.com with two R's and receive 10% off your first order by using the code BREAKING. Find all the digital services you need in one place at Fiverr.com and use code BREAKING. One more time, that's Fiverr.com with two R's and use code BREAKING to save 10%. If you work for a bank or credit union, you already know that this budgeting and planning season is filled with more uncertainty and risk than ever before. And the answers you need aren't in your boardroom or in your spreadsheet models. The team at Alloy Labs has worked with some of the world's most innovative financial institutions, and now our Alloy Co-Labs can help you benefit from multiple perspectives as you learn hands-on how to apply industry-leading tools and frameworks to help you forge ideas into results quickly and cheaply. You can learn more at alloylabs.com/collabs, C-O-L-A-B-S. Our strategy collabs will help you prioritize what are always limited resources to defend and extend your core business while creating viable options for the future. And our customer discovery collabs will help you build a deeper understanding of your customers' changing needs. These are short, hands-on virtual sessions that'll help you get results fast. Space is extremely limited, so go to alloylabs.com/collabs to register now. Times of great change are also times of great opportunity, and the time to act is now. alloylabs.com/collabs.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
And back with us again in the co-host seat is our frequent contributor, Lindsay Davis, the Director of Insights at Caliber Corporate Advisors. Lindsay, you know, you suggested this show and this particular guest, and, you know, I have found her absolutely fascinating and the story of UNESS absolutely fascinating and something near and dear to my heart. But I'm glad you're the one who suggested it. Can you maybe tell the backstory?
Absolutely. The future of education and children and how parents are going to afford that has been in flux. If we look at what's happening with student debt, you know, it impacts 34 million consumers and there's $1.67 trillion. And the pandemic was really an opportunity for the company like UNESS to step up and help parents think through, you know, what could they do to better prepare for their children's financial futures. So when we got the opportunity to work together, they wanted to conduct a market study to see how parents were really taking stock in what was important. And if the pandemic had accelerated that desire, which we will get into, but was one of the things that we noticed from parents during the pandemic, and their desire to save for their children's future has increased. But there's still a big gap in the ability to service that. And that's why I wanted to have Ksenia part of the show, because she can speak to what happened with the product, how they've been able to engage their community of parents, and what they're building next.
So Ksenia, tell us the story of U-Nest. And you know, by way of background, Ksenia Udina is the founder and CEO of U-Nest, a mobile app that makes it easy for families to save for their kids' future. An impressive background coming from the investment space, recently named 40 Under 40 by Investment News. How did you come up with the idea of U-Nest? What you know, drove you in this direction?
Sure. It was an interesting combination of my personal and professional experience. So first of all, I myself graduated from UCLA Anderson with $180,000 in student debt. And a lot of my friends got impacted. One of my closest friends just graduated from USC to become a dentist with $500,000 in student debt. So that's an issue that I feel is affecting a lot of families and a lot of my friends and like our generation. And on another hand, I spent the last 4 years before founding U-Nest working at Capital Group, which is the largest provider of 529 plans, the college savings plans in the nation. And I was vice president working with, you know, high net worth individuals, helping families with their financial planning, with asset allocation, with like all things, you know, to help save for their children. And I just realized that existing solutions available to parents are extremely confusing, time-consuming, and expensive. And for the most part, only people who have access to financial advisors, which is not that many people, have an opportunity to save for their children's future. On the other hand, this is definitely a priority for parents. And we can like talk a little bit about research that we've done with Harris to prove that point. But that was the inspiration, you know, like my personal experience graduating with student debt and also my professional experience working at Capital Group.
So let's talk about this study done with Harris. There's some fascinating data in there that I think we can pick apart. Who had the idea to you know, set up the survey to think you know, specifically about you know, the change that COVID could cause? Because that was counterintuitive to me that you know, a COVID that when there's so many other distractions going on, like you know, massive unemployment, you know, global pandemic and health scare, that college was still on the mind and some of the data around that.
Part of that was why Ksenia and the team came to me. So my background, of course, is in data analytics and research. And one of the first things I wanted to talk through was why did parents come to U-Nest in the first place? So I wanted to do a poll of our existing base and then use the survey as an opportunity to find the market that we already are identifying with and tease out some of the things that matter most. And some of the things that we learned from that study are, you know, the majority of the parents on U-Nest platform felt more confident about their ability to afford their children's financial future. And so from there, I wondered then, you know, what's happening during the pandemic when most people are feeling insecure about their finances because maybe they're dealing with unemployment or, you know, the markets are so volatile. And we saw a massive uptick in some of the consumer fintech apps during, you know, this period of time because many wanted to get in on the volatility, whether that was from a brokerage perspective or an AUM perspective. So my thought there was, you know, if children really are the most important savings and investment goal, then that's probably going to have a similar impact here with a lot less saturation, frankly.
Interesting. And so were you surprised that it was the parents of young children, you know, not even the ones that are approaching college, were the ones that responded so strongly?
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised. It really shows that the younger generation are caring about their children's futures while they're younger, which was not necessarily intuitive because we millennials and Gen Z, they get a bad rap for not thinking, you know, 2 and 3 moves ahead. But when it comes to children, and that's something that Ksenia had helped me understand from, you know, the initial users that they had were that parents cared very deeply about saving for their kids, especially young ones, like young parents with kids, which we identify as 17 or younger. So when we say young children, that's what we mean.
Yeah. Insert joke about millennials and avocado toast here. So Ksenia, were you're even closer to this. Were you surprised by the results or which data, you know, shocked you?
I wasn't surprised about, you know, parents prioritizing kids over retirement, for example, because what's interesting, that's exactly what I observed working in the industry, that conventional wisdom tells us that people need to save for their retirement before the kids. And I always personally disagreed with that statement because I believe, you know, first of all, emotionally, parents feel like very deeply, you know, securing the kids' financial future first, and we have, like, you know, enough time after kids go to college to save for our own retirement, and we can always postpone retirement, but we cannot postpone kids' future. So that wasn't a surprise. And the study showed that, like, parents of young kids select, like, 44% of parents of young kids select saving for their children as a primary priority, and only 18% select saving for retirement as a priority, which was, like, totally in line with my thinking. What was interesting to me was a difference between moms and dads, you know, just difference in gender, and how confident dads are about being able to afford college compared to moms.
Yes, I found that very curious, in that the men said that they are extremely confident in their ability to pay for college, which I don't know that if I were to poll my friends, many would feel that same sense of confidence.
Right. Yeah. And maybe it just has something to do with, like, gender difference, like that men tend to be a little more confident, like, in, you know, generally than women. But what was interesting definitely is that 53% of parents said that during the pandemic, the desire to save for the kids' future, you know, increased. Right. But I think that we can also kind of justify it with the fact that parents just feel more kind of inclined to save for the kids during the time of uncertainty.
Yes. So let's talk about, from the UNES perspective, and how you go about helping solve this. I'm curious if you have any data or insight on, do men and women actually use the application differently?
Yes, actually, we do have some data and some interesting observations. When we started business, we thought that moms actually will be our primary customers, just because usually, you know, women control, you know, money, and they also kind of oversee kids in the family. But what was interesting is that dads were actually our best kind of early adopters, right? And they feel kind of more confident creating the account. They start with larger contributions. They do not close the accounts. They kind of stick with the plan. And I think, you know, kind of the way to explain that is that men usually just feel like a little more confident about investing and finance in general.
Can you speak to, you know, some of the things that we also observed around moms and dads around flexibility, and, like, what did moms prefer in the investment accounts versus what dads prefer? And that's a pretty good segue for what you're building next too.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, like, what was interesting from UNES perspective is that during the pandemic, we started getting a lot of feedback from our users that they want more flexibility in what they save and invest for. So they said, look, we don't want to save just for college. What happens if all education transitions online and all tuition, like, you know, so high, maybe it's unsustainable. We want to be able to save for our children, but for things like their first car, or the wedding date, or the first house. So we want that flexibility. What we decided to do is to launch the new account type that's different from 529 and has actually much more flexibility, but also the tax advantages and no penalties on early withdrawals. The account's called UTMA. And during our study, that was one of the things we wanted to find out, how actually people, you know, moms versus dads, treat the tax treatment versus flexibility.
Yeah.
And what the study showed is that moms prefer flexibility most. So 37% of moms said that they prefer flexibility. And that's more than dads. Only 24% of dads prefer more flexibility. But dads prefer tax-free kind of advantage the most. 42% of dads said that tax-free is very important to them, compared to 21% of moms.
Yeah, I was a little bit taken aback about just how far that gap is between those preferences, mm-hmm. you know, right there. And, you know, does go to show what you expect versus what the research eventually tells you can be, you know, so different. Is there a way that you've been able to help address that within the application?
Yes, that's why we launched this new type of account just, you know, a week ago, and it's in the market. And basically, yes, that's exactly what the account is helping to do. It's also tax advantaged, but it has much more flexibility compared to traditional 529 account. So that was a reaction to the user feedback.
Yeah. How do you actually educate people on that, though? I mean, because I wonder if a lot of, you know, the users, unless you had asked me directly, I don't know that I would have said I ever thought about it when I think of funding our girls' education, you know, the flexibility versus the fixed account. And now I'm second guessing myself. I'm like, why did I make that choice? How did I end up there?
You wouldn't be alone there. So we actually did poll people broadly about this, and we found that 1 in 3 parents feel very confident or extremely familiar with 529. So there's still a wide education gap to go, and it's something that's on the product roadmap for UNESP, but it's a big opportunity. And her background positions her really well to go after that because she understands it, having worked on both sides of it. But it is extremely complicated. You know, it's a state-by-state process, and the flexibility versus, you know, the tax advantages aren't well understood, and they're often not realized until, you know, a couple of years down the road. And now the education's in flux, you know, online education probably being a permanent fixture. I mean, it was for me, at least when I was in college. I spent the majority of those massive business school classes in my dorm room. But, you know, the idea of paying full freight for that just doesn't fly anymore.
Yeah. What is the reaction in the market been to the product?
It's awesome.
Yeah, no, the product is very successful. And I believe actually that one of the reasons it is so successful is because people do not know enough, right, about the differences between different account types. It's so complex, and we make it extremely easy. So simple. Like, our whole positioning in the market is that we make it very simple and easy for people to start saving for their kids' future. And that's such a big emotional kind of, you know, hook right there, right? That's exactly how people think. And there is nothing else that exists in the industry that would make the process so simple and intuitive and affordable.
So what is the biggest set of mistakes that you've seen people make as they're planning for that financial future, the retirement versus the save for college? And I'm really interested in, you know, what are kind of the overt mistakes versus, you know, the much more below the surface ones that we can help try and correct?
I think the biggest mistake that people make is not saving at all, right? Because like what's interesting is that a lot of parents have the right intention. Like, I talked to a lot of my friends, even when I was at Capital Group, and they reached out to me with the question how we can start saving and set up the account. But the process was so complex that a lot of them gave up without even starting, right? And that's the problem and kind of mistake we're trying to solve, making it not only simple, but creating very low barrier to entry that people can start saving with just $25 a month, right? Like, a small, consistent, disciplined investment can make a huge difference over time and can help, you know, their kids to go to college tax-free.
And this is
in a tax optimized way.
Tax optimized way. But this is historically one of the challenges, right? Where the time to pay off is so far in the future, and those small incremental steps just don't feel like they're going to add up to enough. And it becomes easier and easier to say, well, I'll start that tomorrow, or I'll start that, you know, next year. You know, getting people on track and that level of discipline, I think, is pretty important. Have you measured any of your users? Do they stay on track? And like you'd mentioned, the men are more likely to, once they've set the plan, stay on the plan.
Yeah, and we encourage all of our families to set up that monthly plan. We use a very simple college calculator in the app to help them estimate the goal and estimate the monthly investment and kind of get, you know, be committed to it. But they can also go back in the app at any time and make additional deposits. And what's also interesting about our future plans is that by the end of this year, we're planning to release the gifting feature that would help parents receive gifts from grandparents, you know, friends, other family members directly into the child's account. So they're not feeling like they're doing it alone, and they can involve the entire community to help them save for their kids.
Well, you have just ruined the holidays for my nieces and nephew, because I know what they're getting for every holiday and birthday from now on.
Contribution to a college savings account.
Yeah, please add emoji functionality.
Which was a preference. We actually did ask this question as well. We gave parents the option. I mean, we gave all Americans that option. But for parents, 47% of them, which was the lead among all of our options against, you know, gift cards, Zelle, Square Cash, clothes, toys, contribution to a college savings account really was among the top preferences.
Do you think that is something that changed in a post-COVID world where there's a lot more insecurity and concern about some of these expenses and ability to finance things?
I believe actually that during the pandemic world or post-pandemic world, most of the gifts will transition to digital, right? Which is a trend that we're already observing. Even that right now, a lot of people do not have opportunity to meet for the holidays, to meet in person, to come and have a huge birthday party. So how can you still contribute to the child's future? How can we still gift to that child? So I believe, you know, everything will be moving into digital.
And how do you think that trend to digital ultimately, you know, plays out, right? Because the whole world, even our in-person education, is now become, you know, part of the digital. You know, are there more tools, and how do you envision that network you talked about, engaging grandma and grandpa and uncle to participate in this? You know, it takes a community these days to send a child to college. What other tools are on your roadmap, or do you see, you know, any other tools that are doing a great job in this planning and preparation?
Yeah, I believe gifting will be the big one for now, because it takes time to build the entire infrastructure and make it very simple. But our goal is just to simplify process as much as possible. So it takes you just one click to send that gift link to your friends, family, and they can contribute for any occasion.
Yeah, I think, if we're being creative, one of the things that other fintech companies have been able to do is blend the digital and the physical experience, whether it's investing and giving a fractional piece of something, a piece of memorabilia. 529 Super X had that versus when you buy a stock, you can send a copy, because most of those live in my former employer's vault at DTCC, but you wouldn't send a copy of, a 529 certificate. So how can we create that? That could be something very interesting to, again, give the kid the ability to open something up under the tree, okay, yes, he's my future, but I don't know what it's worth yet. So there's ways to be creative here. And I don't think that any, incumbent is thinking about this in a holistic and meaningful way yet. And that's what fintech.
I think you're spot on with the tangibility piece of it, is that has to be part of the equation to reinforce, right? Again, because the payoff is so far in the future. And, when you're young, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I'm guessing day one of going to college, how you felt about your college debt was very different than, graduation day and the first bill that arrived, and how you feel about college debt. And one of the other things, though, that I do like on the virtual side of it, though, is our ability to add more around the behavioral economics and to track what people are doing. And I don't want to say manipulate, but I'll just say shift, and maybe protect them from themselves in, what they're doing just continues to go up.
Right. And as Eunice builds, they'll have that data. They'll be able to say, look at our parents 5 and 10 and 15 years down the road. And that tangible investment becomes real when you see the first Eunice kids go to college. And I think that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah. Sure.
Go ahead, Disney.
I think there is a way for technology to help to instill those good habits in people's behavior, right? If you haven't been saving or you haven't been saving enough, technology can actually help you to estimate the right goal and, make sure you stand on track with that goal. And another thing that you can achieve with moving into this digital world is educate people on the scalable level, right? Through technology or social media or emails, and just, help with the whole financial literacy aspect. You can involve your kids into the savings. You can help them to learn about investing. You can help them to learn about money early on.
Yeah. I'm curious, what are your other favorite finance apps? Because you're obviously a great student of the space. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the educational side. What's in your virtual wallet of finance tricks?
My latest favorite is Greenlight. That also kind of falls into our space, but it helps parents manage expenses for their kids, manage allowances. So I would say that, you know, I'm a big fan of the company, of the team, and what they've invented and how they're helping parents.
How about you, Lindsay? I think you have one of every application out there.
I have a lot. It's really embarrassing. I have like 180 some odd connections through Plaid. You can link to a self audit. I try everything. And some of the things I like are, you know, the frictionless finance that we've discussed, the ability to make investments in things that I'd otherwise not have had access to. I mean, the SPAC craze has started to reach a fever pitch, but you could always invest in Chamath's IPOA on Robinhood. Now that Charles Schwab has gone to zero, having optionality and the ability to sort of hedge against and get access to financial, you know, papers and the content that they put on the platform, so you can get equity research reports. I think that there's a massive gap in education still. So companies that can help, you know, people read and apply those things. There's a lot of new newsletters coming out that are dedicated to that. So I'm excited to see some of these things, you know, bring it all back together. I think that's truly what's missing. We've unbundled, you know, financial services. Now we need to actually rebundle them holistically around how I want to invest and save. Like, I don't have a child today, but I have a niece, and having a 529 contribution to at least take advantage of tax optimization would be surreal if my, you know, financial life knew all the ways in which I was delving up my money.
Well, and I think that is the part that we can't just rebundle back to what we were. You know, the neobanks that are like, hey, we just started as, you know, we were, you know, your deposit account, and then we added savings, then we tacked on, and it's like, okay, you're just a prettier version of what I already had. No, by the way, the best banks have all caught up. How do we rebundle in a way, you right. know, that takes advantage of something like a UNEST?
Well, yeah. And to that point, Greenlight, having been a neobank targeting children first, going D2C, now works with Wells Fargo and JP Morgan to support their child savings accounts. So they catch up by partnering after, you know, failing to build first though on yes. some fronts. But that's for another podcast.
That is another entire episode on, you know, is the fast follower a fallacy or a viable strategy, you know, for the banks. So if someone wants to learn more about UNEST, Cosneo, where should they go to learn about you, and what suggested reading do you have for all of those new parents that are highly concerned about their young children's education?
Yeah, they can go to our website, unes.co, and we have a ton of blogs, a lot of like educational materials posted on the website in our resources section, or they can go into the App Store or Google Play and download the app on the iPhone or Android.
Fantastic. So, Lindsay, thank you for joining us as well. Look forward to that next debate on the fast follower. Cosneo, fantastic to have you, and thanks for making it easier for all of us parents out there to save for college.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us, Jason. Talk to you soon.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.